You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 173. And with me today I have four communicators who have been talking about how nuclear plants prepare for and respond to large weather events. When nuclear plants are designed, there's no doubt in anybody's minds that they will occasionally be in the path of storms, so that is taken into account during the design of the plants. And this week there was a storm that was more threatening than most in terms of the number of plants that were in this path. I counted up today about 18 nuclear plants that were within the spread of Hurricane Irene. So I have Dan Yerman, Margaret Harding, Mimi Limbaugh, and April Shilp. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be here. Thanks
for having us, Rod.
Hi, Rod.
Hey, and let's see. I'd like each of you to give a real brief introduction. We had a nice little chat before we started the recording, but Dan and Margaret have been frequent guests on the Atomic Show, but April and Mimi are new to this show, but you all are wonderful and skilled at your positions. So with that obsequious introduction, please introduce yourself.
Okay, well, this is April Shilp. I'm the Senior Manager for Communications for Exelon Nuclear's Mid-Atlantic region. I have communications responsibilities for Oyster Creek in New Jersey, which was definitely in the direct path of Hurricane Irene, but I also have responsibility for communications for Exelon's other three Pennsylvania plants, which are Limerick, Peach Bottom, and Three Mile Island Unit 1.
And I'm Mimi Limbaugh. I'm a partner with Potomac Communications Group. Our firm specializes in nuclear energy communications, and over the last few days, I've been providing some support to Constellation Energy's nuclear group, which runs the Calvert Cliffs plant. And, of course, as a firm that really focuses on best practices in nuclear communications, we've been watching all of the utilities and companies whose plants have been in the path of Hurricane Irene check out what they're doing and see what they have to teach.
Dan, what have you been up to?
This is Dan Yerman. For the purposes of this call, for the past 3 days, I've been working on behalf of American Nuclear Society, maintaining their blog, ANS Nuclear Cafe. We established a Hurricane Irene nuclear watch and published a daily update on the status of nuclear plants in the U.S. East that were affected by the storm. We had a list of about 200 people, some of who were contributing. Some of the contributors are on this call. You know who you are, all of you, as a matter of fact. And it was a very, very interesting exercise in crowdsourcing in terms of getting information out. We are very pleased with the kind of participation we had.
And last but certainly not least, Margaret.
Yeah, in this particular event, I was more the out there trying to disseminate some intelligence about people who were freaking out that hurricanes were going to bear down on these plants and somehow it was going to turn into another Fukushima event. So while I did a little contributions to Dan, I was more trying to keep people calm. I happen to live about 12 miles from Brunswick, and about 11 miles from GE's nuclear fuel facility, which most people don't really think about as being something you would want to think about in a hurricane if you're going to worry about nuclear. But it's about 10 miles down the road from me as well. So just kind of was out there communicating and was also not in the eye, but was on the sort of leading edge of the strong, as the hurricane came in, Wilmington wasn't too far away. So was having fun with wind and rain.
Well, of course, in recent, the last 8 or 9 months, people have been taught that they should worry about nuclear no matter what the natural disaster is. So,
yeah, right.
But actually, it's actually not a bad thing to hear that nuclear plants are in the path, and to then to find out exactly what happened to those plants as the storms passed overhead. So I count. Let's see. You've got Brunswick 1 and 2, which are the plants near Margaret. Calvert Cliffs 1 and 2, which are the ones near Mimi. Hope Creek, which is who operates Hope Creek? That's PSEG,
right? Hope Creek is PSEG,
right?
Yeah. Along with Salem 1 and 2.
And Hope Creek, right.
And they're right on the Delaware Bay. I've sailed by those a couple of times, so I know they were definitely in the path. Indian Point 1 and 2, right on the Hudson River. Limerick 1 and 2, were they affected at all?
Actually, the Pennsylvania plants were affected by wind and rain in terms of, like, power outages to, you know, some of their emergency sirens. But other than that, you know, they were watching the storm for, you know, wind levels and things like that. But they had tons of margin before they would have had to reduce power or take any action. So the Pennsylvania plants for Exelon were really not expected to be terribly affected. Oyster Creek, however, on the New Jersey shore in Forked River, New Jersey, definitely in the path.
Absolutely. And right on the Barnegat Bay, is that the name of the?
That's correct.
Millstone 1 and 2, which are in Connecticut, were in the path. North Anna 1 and 2 were obviously shut down, obviously for anybody who paid attention to the fact there was a little earthquake about 10 miles from those two plants on Thursday, and they had not yet restarted.
This is Dan. Don't forget North Carolina. You've got Duke has plants there.
The Sharon Harris plants. Right. And the.
I was going alphabetically. I hadn't got to Sharon Harris yet.
Brunswick. You missed Brunswick. They had to.
Brunswick. I think they had to first.
I said them first. They're a B.
They were first up.
Oh, you did. I apologize.
They did. I don't know if they. Did they fully shut down? I know they reduced power.
They reduced power.
Yeah, that's all I remember hearing.
But they didn't. We didn't receive. We just missed hitting hurricane force winds here. They were. I think the recorded at the Wilmington Airport was 72 miles an hour. Brunswick is just a few miles further west, so they probably saw something in the high 60s.
Okay. So let's see. Pilgrim is on the coast of Massachusetts. Yep. Salem 1 and 2 were the ones on we've mentioned before with Hope Creek and the Delaware Bay. Seabrook is on the coast of New Hampshire. Sharon Harris in North Carolina. Surrey 1 and 2 remained at 100% power, even though they're in the Tidewater region of Virginia, which was pretty significantly hit. And I think Vermont Yankee also remained at 100%, even though Brattleboro is underwater. Which is not terribly far from Vermont Yankee. It's up further north on the Connecticut River, if I'm not mistaken.
Also, Millstone is right on the Long Island Sound.
Right, and they were prepared to shut down but didn't need to.
Right.
Yep, so this storm, you know, if you're on the east, it was a pretty significant path in terms of nuclear plants. So, other than, we did a couple of reductions in power at Brunswick, and Oyster Creek did shut down due to predictions of high winds.
And it was
right on the path.
Mm-hmm.
And then Calvert Cliffs, I think, what happened at Calvert Cliffs, Mimi? It was 100% power till...
Unit 1 ended up shutting down after high winds blew a very large piece of aluminum siding into the switchyard. It struck a transformer, which caused Unit 1 of Calvert Cliff to automatically go offline, which, of course, it was designed to do. And so Constellation Energy Nuclear Group declared an unusual event, which is, as everybody here knows, the lowest level of four emergency classifications. So at this point, Unit 1 is offline while the transformer is being inspected. Unit 2 has been throughout the hurricane at 100% power. And I know the folks at Constellation literally have worked around the clock to prepare for Calvert Cliffs for the storm. And I know the communications people worked around the clock to keep up with all of the media inquiries and to keep their internal and external teams up to date on events.
So what are some of the things that a plant does to prepare for a storm?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, and I'm going to defer to those who are actually working in utilities. April, you might be the best person to answer that.
Sure. I can tell you what we did at Oyster Creek. In advance of the storm, there were a lot of things that needed to be done, just like people who have homes near the beach or in typical hurricane paths have to, you know, secure their lawn furniture and things like that, and board up any windows that might be directly susceptible to high winds. We did many of those same actions at Oyster Creek, and certainly went through a lot of training with operators to ensure that they were reminded of the emergency classifications that they might have to enter and at what level wind speed would be, for example, when they had to reduce power. So there were a lot of things, both physical things that needed to be shored up in advance of the hurricane, but then things that they did to refresh their training and just kind of do pre-job briefs, if you will, before they entered these conditions, since it obviously isn't business as usual when you have a hurricane coming. So a lot of things, securing things in the yards and in the areas, anything that might be, blow through the air or be caught up in the wind. And then they also wanted to protect any equipment that they might need in case of flooding or some kind of high wind damage or fire or something like that by making sure that it was in a safe location away from any potential floodwaters and things like that.
Okay, thanks.
And of course, from a communication standpoint, there are every company has crisis plans that they begin to that they operate to. And in the case of Constellation Energy's nuclear group, for example, they also have to keep the corporate entity up to date, because anything involving a nuclear power plant tends to be considered by investors to be material, and so needs to be communicated to the broader public.
Okay.
I can support that, Mimi, as well. That's definitely something Exelon, as I believe most people know and most of the listeners probably are aware, is the largest nuclear fleet in the country. And so we're very sensitive to the fact that, you know, we are often called by the media and by public to just comment on any kind of interesting story that has to do with the nuclear power plant, just because we are the largest fleet. But in specific, our shareholders and our stakeholders are very interested in what we're doing when we have things like this that we can predict and we can reassure them how we're preparing for it. It certainly is something that we want to be very careful about in the corporation and be very mindful of.
Now, it seems to me through reading that there's obviously different design bases for the different plants, because I think I read something from Entergy indicating that Indian Point would not be shutting down unless the winds were predicted to get to 100 miles an hour or greater. But I saw some lower numbers for some of the other plants. Anybody comment on that?
Well, every plant is designed for the expected natural events in their area. So let's take earthquakes because it's a little simpler. Earthquakes on the west, plants on the west coast are designed for more significant ground motion than plants in the than plants in the Midwest or the East Coast, because at the time most of them were built, and even today, the likelihood of earthquakes of the magnitude that one would expect on the West Coast doesn't occur on the East Coast. It's a similar fact with wind and hurricanes. Now, why Indian Point would be designed for a stronger wind speed than some of the other utilities would be a question I can't really answer, other than the concern that it is relatively close to a large population, so you want it to withstand pretty much anything you can throw at it. But beyond that, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that it's a containment building is more is stronger than others and designed to a higher pressure because of that close population.
I believe that's right. And you know, if anybody wanted to get more detail on some of that, several years ago, the plant's owner, Entergy, commissioned an independent safety evaluation panel to go and look at the plant's safety. And their report, I believe, is still available online. There's a website devoted to it.
Okay. I will try to find that and put that in the show notes, because it is a little bit interesting to realize that, Entergy was out there saying, hey, we're doing just fine, and as long as the wind doesn't hit over 100, we're going to keep pumping out the juice, which is...
Well, given their critical input to the New York power grid, New York City power grid, I would think that was really important.
Well, it can't be a critical input because the state of New York is trying to shut down the plant.
No. But we know that.
This is Dan. One of the things about Indian Point that's so important is that New York is a crossroads for freight and defense materials moving from New England to the rest of the country and vice versa. In fact, during World War II, the U.S. government thought that was so important that they put the switch stations and transformers for some of the electric circuits that served the electrified railroads in the area underground. Deep underground in New York City in order to prevent them from being accessible to saboteurs. And the Nazis spared no effort to try and find it. So National Geographic had a piece on this a while back, and it's probably still out there somewhere. It's fairly interesting. And I think that argument still applies today, that the electrified railroads in New York are a national security resource for the nation.
Well, I would imagine there's certainly some people up in the northern sections of New York State and Vermont and Massachusetts that are just hoping that there's going to be no interruption in transportation as they try to recover. I did see a tweet from John Wheeler that said that the Hudson Valley is pretty much a mess right now.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
My husband's cousins live in Albany, and they were just getting hammered. And the thing is that even though we experienced much higher winds down here in North Carolina, and we've been making fun of his relatives in New York and Connecticut, the reality is that they don't receive storms like that real frequently. And these kinds of storms have a tendency to pull over weakened trees or shallow root systems. So if they haven't had a storm like that recently, it's going to just run mayhem up there because it's just going to pull everything over.
Well, they also have an issue where the ground was already saturated.
Right. They've had quite a bit of rain recently.
I could confirm that Martin Langeveld, the former editor and publisher of the Brattleboro Reformer, sent me a note saying that they have a lot of flooding in the area. You may wonder what I'm doing talking to a guy in Vermont. He and I went to high school together in New Jersey a long time ago in a galaxy far away. So we still stay in touch. So he says there's a lot of flooding up there.
Has it affected Vermont Yankee at all? I know they're right on the river.
According to Meredith, they're still operating at full power.
Yeah, I just saw that, which is again, nuclear plants are designed for a lot of considerations, and I believe that Vermont Yankee is significantly higher than the highest flood that the Connecticut River has ever had, which is also one of the advantages of Calvert Cliffs. Mimi can indicate how nicely situated that plant is compared to the potential for water rising in the Chesapeake Bay.
It is. It's on a bluff that essentially overlooks the Potomac, and
The
area around it is considered to be a very desirable place to live. Obviously, not on the plant site, but there are lovely houses in different parts of the cliff. But Calvert Cliffs is certainly well situated not to be affected by flooding, but it certainly can be affected by wind, as happened last night.
And not to correct a guess, but I believe that the body of water is the Chesapeake Bay that I used to look at when I went to the Calvert Cliffs site, rather than the Potomac River.
Oh yeah.
Sorry, Mimi.
Details.
But I used to sail by the Calvert Cliffs site fairly regularly.
It's a beautiful plant site. It is a beautiful plant site.
It's a beautiful plant site for one more unit.
We think so, too. Agreed. We think so, too. Absolutely. And certainly they were well on their way to doing that, but the situation with loan guarantees derailed that, at least for the time being. One of the things that I thought that this storm and the earthquake that we had in the Washington area demonstrated was just how really on it plant communicators are, and how effectively they used social media, and specifically I'm thinking about Twitter feeds, and how effectively they got information out to the public via Twitter, which went so much faster than the traditional way that we as communicators typically have informed the public. You send a press release out and a journalist picks it up and it shows up on a website and, on TV and radio and the broadcast media. But so many journalists are following the different nuclear plants on their Twitter feeds, and so many people who are interested in what's going on there, both those of us in the industry and those of us in communities, and I was pretty dazzled by how fast Dominion and Constellation and Exelon got information out on their Twitter feeds, first during the earthquake, and or I should say in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, and then in terms of getting ready for Hurricane Irene and in reporting the status of their respective plants on Twitter.
Mimi, I'm really so glad that you brought that up, because we were talking as we were preparing for Hurricane Irene within Exelon's communications group that, when this was all over, God willing, we would have a great story to tell, that earthquake plus hurricane equals smooth sailing for nukes. And,
absolutely.
So not only do we have a good story, but I think we're starting to find better ways to tell it in a more appropriate way than we have maybe in the past, because I think I can only speak for myself, but in big corporations, a lot of times, it's hard to get people to be supportive of new channels, because we've kind of done things the same way for forever. And, and I think it's good, it behooves us all to really look at the silver lining as much as we can with things like Fukushima. And then, with these events that we can, we can and must find ways to get our stories out there in environments where people are hungry to receive it, and they want to receive it right now. They don't want to wait until you have your press release through 57 approvals and, you know, faxed to some, you know, trade reporter. They want to know, you know, people want to know what's going on now. And we have an opportunity to really, you know, not only tell that story in a different way, but also, you know, bring along people who maybe didn't understand the value or didn't really understand the necessity to go to use these forms of media, really to bring them along to it. And that's what we were able to do at Exxon. This is the first time we've ever tweeted through any event. That was, it may seem like a small step, but it was huge for us to be able to, you know, have that medium for this particular event. And it was great too that we've been able to start, we have a Facebook page, it's our pilot for Limerick, and which is in the middle of license renewal right now. Mm-hmm. And so you know, getting big huge corporations who are really, you know, kind of have a lot of things that are very proceduralized, to get them to kind of open their minds and be willing to take this step, I think has been, you know, just wider than Irene. I think all of the things that have happened to us all in the last 5 or 6 months with communications and a heightened interest and awareness of nuclear power, we just have a great opportunity.
You know, one of the things
I agree with you, and I take my hat off to you. I spent 25 years with Westinghouse Electric Corporation, so I sure do know about slow-moving corporate yeah. entities. I was struck by, I know, Constellation's nuclear group. They did their first Twitter feed during the hurricane. And earlier in the week, when we had experienced an earthquake here in the Washington area, one of the first things I heard was that the earthquake's epicenter was very close to the North Anna nuclear plant. So I immediately got on Twitter, because I have lots of buddies who were in Dominion's communications organization, and they were just on it. I mean, they had information on the status of North Anna coming out literally 10, 15 minutes after the earthquake, and it was really terrific.
Which is important, really, too, because the cell phones, I don't know what happened down there, but I know even in Pennsylvania, where I was, you know, we felt the earthquake there, and they felt it in New Jersey, and I'm sure we can all say that most of us, maybe not Dan, but mm-hmm. I think all of us probably felt it. But it was difficult to get calls, to get the cell phone network. There was a real tax on the cell network during that time. I missed calls from reporters, for example, because they just couldn't get through. So but I could still send text messages. So, you know, it's a way that you can communicate even when there's not enough of a signal for a phone call. You can often have enough of a signal to be able to tweet. So
absolutely, and we experienced the same thing here in Washington. It was impossible to get a cell phone call or any kind of call for an hour or more after the quake. But to me, Twitter in particular has really transformed the way we communicate during crises and the way people gain information during crises. And it's such a wonderful tool.
Dan,
one of the things that's going on, though, the thing that's common is that you had shifted from voice to data, and you're using a mobile device, and this is the wave of the future. More and more people are giving up their landlines. They may not be able to get a voice line through, but as both of you mentioned, data was moving. And in fact, the data component of mobile systems is growing very rapidly with the rise of tablets and other kinds of mobile devices that depend on these networks. So, and also, if you have a natural disaster, you may have a large number of people who are moving because they've been forced out of their homes by floodwaters or other events. They're in shelters or they're not where they normally are. And the one thing they do have with them is their mobile phones. And so that's really what you've got to rely on is that kind of communication. So your comments about data movement, I think, are really germane.
Yeah, and of course, data being updated on websites is always useful because so many of those mobile devices have the ability to, you know, read a website and look at the summary tables that you were posting on ANS Nuclear and those kinds of things.
Oh yeah! In fact, after my power had gone out, I was checking Twitter. I was checking Twitter and websites on my phone because I didn't have internet and nothing else worked. So.
Yeah, iPad is even better because it gives you this wonderful glow in the dark, I've noticed.
Yeah, there's actually an app on my cell phone. It's an Android phone that I can turn it into a flashlight.
I know my son has that. It's the coolest thing.
Yeah, those are a good thing because they're basically LED flashlights.
Right.
Fairly energy efficient light. And I agree with the comment about the iPad. It's very nice for reading in bed.
One of the things I noticed having watched a little bit of the TV coverage is sitting out here in Cleveland, which did not have either the earthquake or the flood, sort of a pastoral center in the middle of a lot of turmoil, is that grandstanding by television reporters, and two things came to mind in particular. One of the major networks, and I'll just leave them unnamed because everyone probably had some of this. One reporter wades into the storm surge to show how fast it's rising, which I thought, well, that's really stupid. In another couple of minutes, it's going to be over his head, you know. And then the other was a live report from Lower Manhattan, and a reporter breathlessly noted that the water was coming over the top of the jogging path. Great. What about water going into the subway or electrical transformer or something important? Nope, that's the jogging path is what we were getting on this national network. And it just boggles the mind that TV seems to lose the bubble so many times or look for some way to, I don't know if it's reality TV has impacted the medium or what, but
now they're looking for an exciting image to put on the air.
That's why you see the jogging path because they can't show the subway tracks.
They even down here where we go through this on a fairly regular basis. This is my mom's first big hurricane, and so we actually turned the TV off. Because we had warned her that sitting there watching the Weather Channel or the Big Three or any other channel, for that matter, that's giving news, they only update hurricane status once every 3 hours. That's when they fly into the storm, double-check the barometric pressure at the center of the storm, look at the wind speeds, and recalculate the track. What are they going to do for the other 2 hours and 59 minutes?
Show it commercials.
No, yeah. They show the guy wading into the thing. They show a pier collapsing. They
but that's
get out.
Only to keep your eyes glued to the commercials.
No, absolutely. But that also spins up little old ladies like my mother just unbelievably. And so, you know, and it does the same thing to us in the nuclear, for these nuclear plants, because it's that same, oh my God, look, it's destroying that 30-year-old wooden pier that hasn't been maintained. The nuclear plant's next!
Right, exactly. You know, and I'll tell you, this is a little bit of a different angle on what you're saying, Mimi, and I don't think we should necessarily move away from that because it's an interesting, you know, topic. But I think, you know, myself and my plant communicators, Exelon has a communicator, just one, at each of our plants. And so they're like the internal, external, all communications at the plant. And as we were kind of having conference calls and stuff in preparation for this, my Oyster Creek communicator said a number of times, you know, I'm going to disallow the Weather Channel in my house because, you know, it's making me crazy. And I can just imagine, you know, it's making my family crazy. And that started a discussion where we were all like, our responsibility as communicators, you know, tied to an operational side of the business. I mean, that's ultimately we support, you know, the people who are actually running these plants and the plant managers and the executives who are in charge of it. Our responsibility is to ensure them we've got it. We've got the communication stuff. Do not worry about the sensationalistic stuff that you're hearing on TV, because we're going to cover this for you. And I think, you know, going back to the social media angle, I mean, that's one way that we know we can influence the story as quickly as possible. When a lot of broadcast media are trying to find that visual, sensational aspect. And another thing I wanted to bring up was to the point of what they're doing on TV. You know, I have three teenage children, two in college and one at home, and none of them watch TV. None of them do. And, you know, one of my sons, I had to tell him that Philadelphia was getting ready for a major, you know, potential of flooding and some problems in the city, because even though he lives in this urban community and is very, very tied into all kinds of social media and pretty much lives on Reddit, he had no idea that, you know, he should worry about this. Now, of course, as it got closer, then people started talking about it on Twitter and Facebook and those kinds of things, and he was more aware. But the only thing he's going to watch about a hurricane coverage from TV is when one of those really ridiculous things makes it to YouTube. So, and this is the thing that about social media, I think that, you know, kind of maybe inadvertently helps us out when we're trying to tell a story, because when people go back to the record of it, you know, we're going to have our responsible tweets out there and website updates and things like that. But what the broadcast media is left with is, you know, kind of crazy stuff that people think to like on YouTube. One in particular comes into mind. This guy I think it was Ocean City, Maryland, was standing by the seawall, and it was creating this foam as the waves came across the seawall. And he was, there's this picture of him just standing, and he looks like somebody took, you know, like scrubbing bubbles and sprayed them all over him. And you know, he went on like this and did this interview for a really long time. And, you know, it was just a weird phenomenon, and that's what people are going to remember from the visual part, because it's really huge on YouTube right now.
One of the things that the TV likes to do is they go into these areas where people have been told to evacuate, and they go looking for people, say, hell no, I'm not going to evacuate.
Exactly.
What I really liked was New Jersey Governor Christie got a press conference and said, you know, get the hell off the beach. It's 4:30. Your tan is done, you know.
It's great. What did Mayor Bloomberg say?
He was on TV this morning, and he was recounting how some first responders, the words he used were something like, had to put their lives on the line to rescue people who were sailing as the hurricane was approaching. And he hoped that all of those who had not left the city, had not evacuated the low-lying areas, would stay put and not ask first responders to put their lives on the line for doing something frivolous like that. And, I mean, he really, I'm probably not saying it as quite as strongly as he did, because, you know, he doesn't mince words, but it was good.
I'll go back to a hurricane many years ago now, but when Hurricane Fran hit this coast back in 96, people thought they could stay on Wrightsville Beach when a hurricane very similar to this one nailed Wilmington. I went through the eye of that hurricane. And they realized the mistake they'd made, and they called 911. Amazingly, the call went through, and the responders said, we're really sorry. And he said, what do you mean? And they said, we can't come get you. And the guy survived, but he didn't think he was gonna. And it was like, learn the lesson, people.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's
not a party.
That's exactly right. Not a party.
Not a party.
People lose their lives.
Oh, absolutely. They lose their lives just out walking around. They don't understand how dangerous it is, because trees come down, no notice. You know.
Well, exactly. Yeah. In our neighborhood in Washington, one came down a few blocks away. A huge old tree blocking the street. If you'd been out in it, it would have been awful.
Yeah.
And Washington got got by pretty well, all things considered. We just got the outer edge of the storm. But
I was actually in New Jersey last night, about 10 miles away from Oyster Creek, hunkered down in a hotel initially, and then I made my way to Oyster Creek's emergency off-site facility just to be there, you know, to get any kind of close communications if necessary from the plant. But I'll tell you, the worst part of the storm in, at least for me and for the location where I was there, in Ocean County, it was the 3 hours, there was like a 3 or 4 hour period where there were tornado warning after tornado warning after tornado warning.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I was up most of the night, and there were a lot of, you know, loud winds, but nothing was worse than that period where it was pretty much constant battering of wind. And then, you know, my iPad kept bleeping and saying, this area has a tornado warning, and this area has a tornado warning. And, you know, I was going to go to the EOF before that, but I was like, well, I'm not going to get in my car and drive the 3 miles to that at this point in time. And it was amazing how many people were still on the roads or were, you know, outside hanging out and stuff at that point in time. And it was just kind of amazing the way people just really, I guess, don't have the same sense of risk. And maybe that's being so closely associated with a nuclear power environment for such a long time that I have a different perception of that, but definitely.
You actually make a marvelous point, because that's a point that I've tried to get across to people, is you're safer at the power plant than you are driving around in those storms. Far safer than you're driving around on a sunny day to be at the nuclear plant during a storm. And they look at me really strange, but yes, the front quadrant where you guys were is the worst, because you get all these little microbursts and weird little tornado things, and it's fun times.
And that's another thing that nuclear plants are designed to withstand is those tornadoes. I mean, just think about the kinds of things that we've proven this year that nuclear plants have been able to run through. You know, we've had tornadoes, we've had significant flooding like in Nebraska, we've had nuclear facilities be threatened by fire out at Los Alamos, earthquakes, hurricanes, all in a very short period of time. And, you know, they just are very durable, resilient facilities with large concrete structures that, you know, the engineers think about these things when they design them, they're able to withstand whatever nature can throw at them. You know, I think it's pretty amazing. Now, I really wish I would be able to find out more about what happened to things like pipelines and refineries and other facilities that are, you know, relatively close to the coast.
Gas lines. Gas lines in urban areas.
Well, there were reports in New Jersey that the Bayway Refinery and I think one of the other ones in New Jersey shut down for the duration. They just decided not to operate, which, you know, you've got cracking towers and all kinds of other stuff with lots of volatile stuff in it. You don't want it, moving around when that's happening. So they did shut down. By the way, there was a big fire out west in Idaho, had a huge range fire this week. They just got it out this morning. These guys have been pumping out their press releases, and outside of Idaho, I don't think anyone paid any attention, but you do.
Except that you've tweeted.
I tweeted. Somebody pay attention because you read it, but
I've been paying attention because I'm headed there next week.
I worked in the desert out there the last 5 years I was at Idaho. Let me tell you, when there's a big range fire burning, people are popping out of their trailers, you know, with binoculars trying to figure out where the hell the thing is. It's headed your way. You want to go in the other direction.
Yeah, but see, the problem, Dan, is that really nobody paid attention to a range fire in Idaho because really nobody lives there. I'm sorry.
But that's a good point. That's a good point, too.
Okay, one of the reasons we have range fires in Idaho is because we have 6-inch rainstorms in Idaho. And what that means is that the raindrops come down 6 inches apart. And that's that.
Well, those of us who go to Idaho Falls love it.
Beautiful city. I've been there.
Oh, Idaho is a great place.
I'm just teasing. But
the reality is that the
news media doesn't really think much about the vast wasteland between the two coasts.
Rod, that's a really good point, too.
That's
true, unless for Calhoun. Yeah, exactly. So, but that's a good point about this hurricane. I think one of the reasons there was so much interest and so much hype and craziness about it is because the biggest media market in the United States could be affected by it, you know? So I really think that and the same thing really with the earthquake this week. I mean, I think if that had happened in, you know, California, we would have heard a lot of stuff about it. But, you know, there's no place like the great, you know, condensed population centers of the Eastern Seaboard and really the Northeastern Seaboard to get really, really interested en masse about nuclear power plants because, you know, they like to certainly help heighten everyone's interest when there's something that could threaten them.
Well, in general, people are selfish, and they pay attention to things that are going to affect them. And so I would imagine that the ratings for the networks were quite high because people were very concerned about what's happening, what they need to know about. And, you know, although there's a lot of reasons to criticize the media coverage, as I tweeted, people kept watching, so why would they change?
True. Exactly.
Well, this is always a puzzle to me, is why the television stations have all this stuff on. If 4 million people have no power, who's watching?
Exactly.
They keep hoping that they've got battery-powered TVs out there or something.
That's right.
But the other thing is that there's a certain level of, my dad used to watch car races back in the 70s when I was growing up, and he really hated car races. He didn't care about, it was the damn wrecks. Okay,
yeah.
A lot of people used to go to car races just to see the crash, and so their news is as much about the train wreck as anything else.
That's right. It's hard to look away.
That's part of why, you know, the performance of the nuclear stations during the storm is not going to be much of a story because it's pretty boring. There really wasn't much to talk about. And there are not going to be any tremendous visuals, I don't think, coming out of this.
Well, the press will not give you an attaboy because your contingency plan worked.
Yeah, no. And that's what I was just going to say, is that nobody gets credit for what didn't go wrong. So
that's
no one's
exactly
going to go
right
out there and go, what a great job all the nuclear plants did. They didn't get in trouble, because the next word out of, let's pick a name, Riccio's mouth is, they got lucky.
Right.
Wasn't planning. It wasn't good performance. It was luck.
Yeah, those darn nuclear plants get lucky all the time, don't they?
Yeah.
They keep
dodging.
I don't
even know why we employ all those risk analysts or anything. I mean, it's all about luck.
Yeah, they keep dodging the big one, you know. Near misses and close calls. But, you know, as I have learned over the years, and I can't claim that I was this way naturally, preparation works. It makes for very boring stories after everybody else is all worked up about all the terrible things that they had to go through when their roof blew off and they didn't have water. And, you know, it's much nicer to simply say, well, I feel sorry for you.
This raises the issue of why Twitter was so important, and why April's comments about Twitter and Mimi's comments about Twitter are so important, is because the people tend to look for immediacy, and the nuclear utility that makes effective use of the immediate nature of Twitter is the one that's going to get its message out.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know, to put out a press release now saying, we were ready for Irene and everything went well, yeah. Nothing.
Yeah, it's not going to do. Nobody's going to even care.
No.
No. Well, and it's not. Nobody's going to care, and it's not going to cut it. Whereas, if you're out there,
in social media as it's happening. Because people are even when they're out of power, they can pick up Twitter on their handheld devices, whatever they are. You're communicating in real time.
Exactly, and it's a sense of community for people as well. So they kind of look for that. It's not a talking head on the TV screen. It's someone they know or someone they trust is also involved in that community that they probably have in people they follow in Twitter. And I'll tell you, I mean, this is a little bit irrelevant, but I think, Margaret, I think it was you who at some point post-Fukushima were talking about how the heroes.
Oh, yeah.
The heroes and really the necessity of storytelling in yeah. and making and humanizing these things. You know, at Oyster Creek, hundreds of people really, you know, put their own personal concerns for their safety, their family's safety, and their property's safety, you know, in their back pocket and went and did their jobs. And went and did their jobs because it's what they do, and it's what they're trained to do, and it's the most, it really and truly is for those people who work at nuclear power plants every day, the most important thing they think about, yep. and it's shown in their actions, is protecting the health and safety of the public.
Yeah, absolutely, and that message is one we as an industry need to get out more, because as I said to a producer who shall remain nameless, who's the most famous nuclear worker on the planet?
Exactly.
Homer exactly. Simpson.
Yep. Yeah. You know, I knew she was going to go there. I wasn't going to be the one to say that.
I'll tell you, we're kind of harking back to Fukushima, but it relates exactly to what we're talking about here. This guy did, it was a really long interview, and he kept wanting me to talk about how frightened the workers at Fukushima must be when they had to go into those dark buildings and they didn't know when they were going to turn a corner and their dosimeter alarm might go off. And he just had this vision of these frightened sheep. And I finally looked at the guy and I said, you need to stop thinking of them that way. They are like firemen.
Right.
They go in when others run out.
And, exactly.
And it's like this light went off. And I said, the more accurate description yet is they're really like airplane pilots. You want the airplane pilot to have a really boring day. You really
exactly.
do. Because if he has an exciting day, it isn't a good thing. And nuclear power plant workers are the very same way. We want them to have a boring day, but we want them to be very ready when things go on.
Oh, that's exactly right.
And part of being a responder is not that you're really courageous, but that you understand the risks. You know what to do to protect yourself. You know what you do to keep your yeah. equipment safe. You maintain it properly. You do all those boring things that, you know, those engineers and technicians, you know, get a charge out of. You know, we do things that other people are not interested in doing, but we do it for a very important reason. And, you know, I feel, you know, and I've told this story many times already, but I've been around the electric power industry my entire life. My dad was a lifelong electrical engineer for a power company, and one day a month, he always went to storm training. And when we had hurricanes, I grew up in South Florida, that was not an uncommon event. As soon as the storm ended, Dad grabbed his hard hat and went out to put up power lines. And that's the kind of people that are employed in the electric power industry, because it is a vital part of our modern society.
Oh, yeah. Our power went out here about 8 o'clock or so Friday night, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. While the winds are still blowing and it's still raining here, my power came back on. So they were out there. As soon as the wind got below, I think it's 39 miles an hour, they were out there putting power lines back up.
And that happens all the time. I mean, I remember having, you know, power workers get cheered on streets that I've lived on where, you know, after 2 or 3 days without power, you really, really want to see those trucks come in. And when you're in Charleston, South Carolina, and you see a Florida Power and Light Company truck come in to put up your power lines, you really recognize what kind of industry it is.
It might be worthwhile, maybe April and Mimi, you might want to talk about this, is the mutual aid relationships the utilities have with each other.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a you mean from the power line perspective, from the poles and wires perspective? Yeah. So I can just give you a personal example that might illustrate really what goes on. Is I was driving from my home in Pennsylvania to the Jersey Shore yesterday to get there before, you know, any kind of serious weather. I was probably the only actual car heading east on the Pennsylvania and New Jersey turnpikes, but there was a lot of traffic. I saw a ComEd truck, I saw PECO trucks, I saw PPL trucks. So all of these different poles and wires utilities from Pennsylvania were headed towards the hurricane. Because obviously the damage was expected to be greater the further east you were. And so various utility trucks from all over the state and even outside of the state were making their way into this storm. And I've seen this before just in my travels. My oldest son went to the University of Miami for a very short period of time, and we delivered him to school as a tropical storm was on its way. And if that wasn't harrowing, I really don't know what is. But as we were driving to come home from that trip, when we dropped him off at school, we saw all these trouble trucks headed south towards Florida, and this was in Virginia. So we were seeing, you know, all sorts of different power trucks from Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, you know, they were all headed down into the storm to help out. And it's just one of those things that I think, especially in light of, you know, the challenges that we've had to deal with from a communication standpoint, you know, to the U.S. power industry and nuclear power industry in specific, really there's this understanding that is what you would do. There was a big question in a lot of people's minds about Japan, like how didn't they get the power there faster? And certainly, you know, unimaginable challenges with an earthquake and a tsunami. But I think it's in the mindset of anyone who works in the power industry that, well, at Exelon, we would just call PPL or First Energy and ask them to help us out. And, you know, that's what they would do. And probably before the call was even completed, somebody would have already been on their way.
That's right. We see that with our clients all the time. And the local utilities here, well, utilities throughout the country, are ready to deploy crews at a moment's notice to help other utilities out, because they know that the time will come that they're going to need comparable support. And in fact, during one of the last storms here in the Washington area, there are a lot of trees here, and so people lose power fairly frequently. The local utility in Washington, Pepco, was severely criticized because it didn't ask for help from other utilities in a timely enough way, and that was in comparison to Baltimore Gas and Electric, which did, and they were severely criticized, not just by consumers but by the local regulatory authorities, and presumably they've done better this time around.
Well, looking at my clock, it looks like we're running on an hour. Does anybody have any thing that they really haven't had a chance to talk about before we say call it a night?
I guess I just want to emphasize, this is Mimi, one of the themes that I think we've all touched on is that in a hurricane situation, in a crisis situation like this, in addition to responding to the crisis, it really is an opportunity to educate a very broad group of stakeholders and audiences about how well prepared our industry is, and how really rigorously nuclear power plants are designed and operated. And I think we've done that, and I think during the coming week, as the media does their stories on looking at the hurricane retrospective, we get an opportunity to amplify that message.
Well, and one of the things I do want to jump in on is the industry can't do that just when the storm is coming, because as you mentioned before, people develop these relationships and these trust and communities well before the storm comes. So if you want to be able to share your message during the storm, you have to do the groundwork ahead of time to develop that confidence and trust that when you say something, it's worth listening to.
You sure do.
I'd like to say something in closing. Mimi made a comment about trees in Virginia, and I want to tell a little story. I lived and worked in Colorado for a number of years before moving to Virginia in the late 70s, and I remember driving through Virginia thinking two things. Okay, I'm used to navigating by looking to where the Front Range is, and where the hell did all these trees come from?
Well, as a resident of Virginia, I love trees, so... All right, folks. Thank you very much for everything you've been doing for the last several days, and keep up the good work, and thanks for joining me tonight for a very interesting and lively discussion. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us, Rod.
There's a way, such a better way today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.